Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskianis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record and the audio and transcript will be available on our website, CFR.org, if you would like to share with your colleagues. We are delighted to have Jamila Biggio with us to talk about the role of women in security, peacebuilding, and peacemaking. Ms. Biggio is CFR's Adjunct Senior Fellow for Women in Foreign Policy and Senior Director in Media Technology Solutions. Previously, she served in the Obama administration as Director for Human Rights and Gender on the National Security Council. Ms. Biggio also advised the White House Council on Women and Girls on its international priorities and First Lady Michelle Obama on adolescent girls' education and the Let Girls Learn initiative. She was also senior advisor at large for global women's issues and was detailed to the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and to the mission to the African Union. She received the U.S. Department of State Superior Honor Award and the Department of Defense Secretary of Defense Honor Award for leading the interagency launch of the U.S. National Action Plan on Women, Peace, and Security. She's also worked at the UN and at grassroots level for public health NGOs. Welcome, Jamila. Thank you very much for being with us today to share your expertise. I thought it would be terrific if you could start by talking about the unique but often overlooked role that women can play in alleviating conflict and increasing stability.
Great. Thank you so much, Irina, and thank you to everyone who's on the call. I'm really looking forward to this discussion. So let's look first at what some of the global security trends are of the 21st century. So recurrent and armed conflicts, expanded terrorist and extremist networks, record levels of mass displacement are some of the trends that are defining security in this century. Data shows that standard peacemaking methods have proven ineffective at addressing these trends. Nearly half of the conflict resolution agreements forged during the 1990s failed within 5 years, and 90% of civil wars in the 2000s occurred in countries that had already experienced civil war during the previous 30 years. I would argue that this data means that new thinking on peace and security is needed. So, what are the alternative options that we have? A growing body of research suggests that standard peace and security processes routinely overlook a critical strategy that could reduce conflict and advance stability, the inclusion of women. Several quantitative analyses have indicated that higher levels of gender equality are associated with a lower propensity for conflict, both between and within states. One study found that the substantial inclusion of women in a peace negotiation makes the resulting agreement 64% less likely to fail and 35% more likely to last at least 15 years. Now, if we look across the conflict continuum, we find both quantitative research and qualitative case studies of the effect of women's participation at each stage of a conflict. Looking first at conflict prevention and early warning, let's take preventing violent extremism as one example. Women are well-placed to challenge extremist narratives in homes, schools, and social environments, and we know that they have particular influence among youth populations. But while the research shows that they effectively disseminate anti-terrorism messages throughout their families and their communities, governments and nonprofits rarely include them in efforts to combat radicalization, instead focusing on political or religious leaders who are predominantly male. This is a missed opportunity on a critical issue. The other thing we know is that women can help detect early signs of radicalization because their rights are often the first targets of fundamentalists. We've seen this with the Taliban in Afghanistan, with the self-proclaimed Islamic State group, and with Boko Haram in Nigeria. Now let's look at peacemaking. This is where there's a lot of research that is documenting the ways in which women's participation in peace processes contributes to the achievement and longevity of peace agreements. There's actually a recent qualitative review of 40 peace processes since 1990 that found that parties were significantly more likely to agree to talks and to subsequently reach an agreement when women's groups exercised strong influence on the process as compared to when they had little or no influence. Let's break down what the research says about why this is the case. Women often take a collaborative approach to peacemaking. They organize across cultural and sectarian divides, and this has helped them push specific priority issues in the agreement. We've seen this where women have built coalitions across ethnic, political, religious divides, including in Afghanistan, in Northern Ireland, and in Somalia. Including women at the peace table can also increase the likelihood of reaching agreement because women are often viewed as honest brokers. This perception is in part informed by the reality of women's exclusion. Women often operate outside existing power structures. They often do not control fighting forces themselves. So they're often perceived by political parties as being more impartial mediators in the negotiation compared to men. We've also seen in conflict contexts around the world that women use tactics to pressure parties to begin or recommit to peace negotiations, as well as to sign accords. We've seen them stage mass action and mobilize public opinion campaigns to help get to and hold peace talks. There's a great film on Liberia called Pray the Devil Back to Hell, if you haven't seen it, which captures the story of Lema Gbowee, who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for the role that she played with others to help mobilize women's groups across Liberia to put pressure on parties to go to and then to go to peace talks, and then they put pressure on them not to leave the premises until they'd reached a negotiated resolution. That was an important step on Liberia's road to recovery. Because women tend to have different social roles and responsibilities than men, they also have access to information and community networks that are different than their male counterparts. We saw in 2006 there were negotiations in Darfur that had been deadlocked over control of a particular river. Local women advised the male negotiators, who themselves were rebel group leaders that were living in the diaspora, that, in fact, the river in question had actually dried up several years prior. Women had access to this knowledge because of their roles, because of where they were coming from, that helped the negotiation break this impasse. We also see that women frequently raise issues in conflict resolution that goes beyond military action or power-sharing agreements or territorial gains, and they instead raise broader issues like political and legal reform, social and economic recovery issues, employment, education, healthcare, the kinds of things that are actually fundamental to a society rebuilding post-conflict, and that helps make the agreements more durable. We also see women play a role in peacekeeping and the security sector. So female security officials, research has shown, are more likely than their male counterparts to de-escalate tensions without the use of excessive force. This contributes to fewer misconduct complaints, and it also enhances the community's perception of the security forces' integrity. This is critical. Rebuilding the relationship between communities and security forces in a society's post-conflict recovery is necessary, especially when communities may have felt abandoned or, in some cases, abused by security forces. So it's important that there are efforts to encourage representation of women in security forces, whether police, military, or peacekeepers. In post-conflict recovery and rebuilding, we also see that women are more likely to direct post-conflict resources to the reconstruction of public institutions. And research has shown that strengthening women's political and social participation after conflict actually diminishes the chance of a relapse of the conflict over time. So building on all this evidence, there's been growing international commitment to promote women's leadership in peace and security. In 2000, the United Nations adopted Security Council Resolution 1325, which was the first of eight resolutions to date that through which the United Nations has recognized and committed to the importance of women's participation in security, as well as the importance of protecting them from sexual conflict-related sexual violence. As of 2016, over 60 countries, from developing nations like Afghanistan and Kenya to high-income countries like the United States and Japan, have developed national action plans on women, peace, and security. This is a tool that helps governments advance their national efforts to increase women's participation in peace and security processes. Regional and multilateral bodies like the African Union, NATO, the G7 have also made commitments in this area. But what we've seen, though, is that despite this growing international recognition of women's roles in security, their representation in peace and security processes has still lagged. So between 1992 and 2011, women represented fewer than 4% of signatories to peace agreements and 9% of negotiators. In 2015, only 3% of UN military peacekeepers and 10% of UN police personnel were women, which is substantially lower than the UN target of 20%. And despite the role that we know that local women's groups play in their countries in helping to prevent and resolve conflict, they received just 0.4% of the aid to fragile states from major donor countries in 2012 to 2013, as one example. Now, one reason for these figures is that there's a significant gap in translating the rhetoric that we see now in the international space to action and to real investment. Part of the reason for this is that key leaders are not sufficiently convinced by the evidence that it is necessary to expend time and resources on women's participation, given competing priorities in the security space. They make a whole range of arguments. We can run through some of these quickly. We've heard skeptical foreign policy experts say that involving new actors, including women's groups, in a negotiation would threaten their already fragile deliberations. But evidence shows otherwise. We've actually found that women's participation, in fact, decreases the threat of spoilers to negotiations, and it increases public perception of the legitimacy of the talks. We also hear traditional culture as a reason that there are just not women in some of these societies who are in a position to participate. The fact is that there are women leaders from countries from Afghanistan to Yemen that have participated and want to participate, and there are local actors in these societies that are leading calls to find ways to help ensure that women are engaged in the dialogue. Others claim that women just don't have the technical expertise in some of these societies needed to effectively contribute to the process. This is true that women have limited experience in national politics and the armed forces in some of these societies because they've been dramatically underrepresented, but this gap is actually closing. There's been a big focus on training and capacity building, and in a lot of these peace and security processes, civil society organizations have actually identified a pool of qualified female experts that are ready and on hand if given the opportunity to participate in the negotiation. Critics also maintain that the evidence just isn't there that establishes women's contribution to peace and security. And this is where, you know, yes, there's been a historical exclusion of women from these processes, so there are fewer examples of women's positive influence in this arena, but the empirical analysis is really growing. And we think, you know, as I've run through on this call, that there's really enough evidence there on the effect of women's participation in peace and security that warrants a stronger investment in providing them opportunities to engage and contribute. Let me close there and open the floor. Really look forward to any questions that you all have.
Thank you so much. Let's open up to the group for questions. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please press star one. Our first question comes from Mox Foreign Affairs, University of Toronto.
So my question is, we talked a little bit beforehand about the necessity of including both top-down and bottom-up approaches to including women in the security process, but obviously there's a certain level at which that marriage needs to take place, and I guess my question is, what level is that?
I'm sorry, I caught most of that, so just to make sure, so your question is looking at both top-down and bottom-up efforts.
Yes. And where those two need to intersect to create meaningful change.
Right. Okay, got it. Thank you. So I think you're spot on that that this is an area where it is critical to have both top-down and bottom-up approaches. Let me take the example of an ongoing peace negotiation to highlight how these two work together. So while the top-down approach is to advocate for opportunities for women to participate in peace negotiations, both as members or leaders of the negotiating teams and the mediating team, as well as to find avenues for civil society to help inform the negotiation and inform the issues and priorities of civil society as the teams are negotiating what the agreement will look like. So the top-down piece is to advocate for that opportunity and to provide training and resources to help make sure that local women's groups, that women in government or in other parties have the opportunity to participate in the talks. But at the same time, that work is really needed at the national, down to the grassroots level, of local women's civil society groups, networking and advocating amongst themselves, helping to raise the issues into the negotiating process. And you know, as I noted, in many societies, that work is going on by women already, and the piece that's really missing and that's needed is the top-down piece, is both conflict-affected governments committing to, as well as donor countries, supporting efforts to really bring, ensure that local women and women at national levels and leadership roles have a real opportunity to contribute in a meaningful way.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Fordham University.
Hi, my name is Kelsey, and I'm a master's student in Fordham's International Political Economy and Development Program. And we're working on an index to measure poverty based off of Pope Francis's views on international development and poverty. And we've found a lot of good indicators for measuring gender equity, but there hasn't been enough widespread data across countries. So I was wondering if you had any recommendations for strong indicators to measure gender equity. One possibility that we've discussed is political participation or peace negotiations, women being able to be involved in these. But I was wondering if you know of any good data or of anyone working on this.
We're actually working on an interactive around women and security that's going to be drawing from some data sets that I think look at some of the questions that you're raising, and it's wonderful to hear about the initiative that you all have underway. There are a few strong indices that I'd point you to that you can look and see if there are within that any specific indicators that work for your purposes. So UNDP has a gender inequality index. The World Economic Forum has a global gender gap index. And the organization, OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, has a Social Institutions and Development Index. And so some of those are either, as I noted, focused on gender equality issues or include strong indicators around gender equality, and they may be a good source for you all. Some of the indicators that the research focused on conflict specifically have found to, in the empirical analysis, have found to be linked to conflict onset or relapse. Some of the issues they've looked at are fertility rate, percentage of women in the labor force, rate of maternal mortality, and percentage of women in parliament. So these are some of the indicators, just to give you an example, that quantitative research has shown has an association with conflict onset or relapse.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Texas, Austin.
Hi, my name is Emily Whalen, and I am a doctoral student in the history department focusing on issues of national security and U.S. foreign policy. My question is, to what degree could we attribute some of this hesitancy or skepticism about women's participation in peacekeeping and state building to the fact that the national security establishment of a lot of donor states, and more specifically the United States, is also overwhelmingly male, and that there are not a lot of women security experts?
Well, one piece that we see, not just in the security space, but in other sectors, is that people often give opportunities to people who look like them or have had similar experience as them. This is an issue that has come up, for example, in research in corporate America, as we look at what are steps to be taken to help advance economic opportunities for women and leadership roles for women in senior economic in the business sector, in the private sector. So I think you can certainly look at what some of these findings mean in the national security space as well, where there are questions about looking at the importance of different perspectives and different experiences in society, and the need to, if you're kind of asking a national security leader to invest in opportunities for women to contribute to security forces, or highlighting what women have to contribute to early warning or to security sectors or to peace-building efforts writ large. And there's also a piece there of asking national security leaders to understand and give value to the experiences and perspectives of women in society. Now, I think that there are male and female national security leaders who can and do take that step and do give value to the experiences of many different groups in society, but it is for some to take a step beyond their own specific experience or perspective, and that's where we're trying to encourage more leaders to do that. I'd highlight, if you're interested, we also have on our website, on CFR.org, an interview, a roundtable that I hosted with Michelle Flournoy, who's currently the CEO of the Center for New American Security and previously held a senior leadership role in the Defense Department. And she reflected in our conversation on what does the Defense Department and the defense community, how does women's participation matter from the perspective of the defense community? And part of our conversation looked at the role of women in national security as national security leaders and how that's influencing the debate.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Connecticut.
Hello. I had a question about women's physicality in combat. I know that you focused a lot on the cerebral portion of security and post-conflict while mentioning women's roles and practical security roles. I do note that women are able to compete physically, but most often the women that are volunteering for these roles have the standards lowered for physical fitness, and mostly in the military, as seen in the Army, even though we've recently opened up combat roles to women. My question was, what do you think about these standards being lowered, and do you think that that hurts women's ability to develop in combat roles overall, because it kind of gives something for them to fight against?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing to note is when the U.S. Defense Department announced in 2015 that it would open combat occupations in all branches of the U.S. Armed Forces, when Defense Secretary Carter observed that fully integrating women into all military positions will make the U.S. Armed Forces better and stronger. So one part of this is the decision that the Defense Department and the U.S. government broadly took to open all combat positions to women. And this was based on the conclusion that it would make the armed forces better and stronger, and that is something that the U.S. military should pursue. But I think, you know, in the long run, that's the vision. And I think, you know, there are many military leaders that are speaking on this point, that understands that to face the national security threats that we are facing today, we need to put the best team on the field. And to do that means that we have to be able to tap from all potential actors, including 50% of the population that have, you know, a whole range of skills and perspectives that they can contribute, but have not always had the opportunity to. So I think the bottom line is that you know, women, once given the opportunity, will prove themselves and prove what they can contribute and prove how they will make the U.S. Armed Forces better and stronger through their participation.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Tuskegee University.
Hello, my name is Jordan Kurtz. I'm a junior political science major, and I was wondering, as your research grows and you empower more people to be, or more women to be involved in these roles, what does that mean for our international security, and how do those things affect other people's ways of life and when they are securing their nation?
Thank you. That's a great question. I think, you know, one thing that we think is really critical in the effort to shift both U.S. government practice around peace and security in order to make it more inclusive, as well as, you know, to change the practices of our partner nations and multilateral institutions. One of the key efforts to do that is to really ensure that the rising generation of diplomats and of security professionals recognizes that women's participation in security helps, that it advances U.S. stability, it advances global security. And so, you know, one area where we're really targeting efforts is how do you reach and better train the rising generation of diplomats and of security professionals so that as they are studying and understanding national security issues and what things the U.S., what tools and strategies and programs the U.S. government has to address different national security risks, that these professionals have as one of the, you know, in their toolbox, an understanding of the importance of engaging women's participation and what women have to contribute if we more effectively include them in conflict prevention and resolution efforts.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from University of the South.
Cool. Okay, so you mentioned earlier that women that are like well-placed in societies have a significant impact on the youth there, and that often women are the first targets of extremism. So my question is extremism less likely to occur, or is it less prevalent in countries where there's greater gender equality?
Hello?
That's a great question. I don't have at my fingertips the research itself on that. If we think about what some of the hotbeds are of terrorism and violent extremism today, from Afghanistan to Nigeria, these are certainly countries where we do not see high levels of gender equality. That said, there are certainly violent extremists and terrorist attacks in societies where there are higher levels of gender equality, from the United States to European countries. So, it doesn't protect fully, but I think it is one of the contributing factors in a society to helping build higher levels of stability. And this is one of the things that the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Index has shown, that societies that have higher levels of gender equality are also more stable and more prosperous societies. If you then go down into the details of the counterterrorism and work to prevent violent extremism, whether it's domestically here in the United States or domestic programs in European countries, for example, there too is where we're encouraging that there's more outreach, for example, in the United States, that there's more outreach to women in communities that are at risk, and so that they are engaged in community-level responses here to help combat radicalization, to help identify early signs of radicalization, et cetera, so that our national efforts are stronger at preventing violent extremist attacks here.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from New College of Florida.
All right. Hello.
Hello.
Our question is, we heard you were talking about how women are generally perceived as honest brokers because they are traditionally excluded, or in a lot of cases excluded from the political sphere. So our question is there any evidence to support the claim that women would still be considered honest brokers if they're more actively involved in the political sphere? As we see in the U.S., especially right now in the presidential election, there's a lot of controversy around Hillary Clinton in particular, despite the fact that she's a woman. Just once you have someone involved in the political sphere, does that inherently make them perceived as less honest?
That's a very interesting question. I'm going to take it and just focus on the peace and security side of the question. One area is part of the research of why women are seen as honest brokers and where they are marginalized is in part about the political sphere. It's in part also because they are often less likely to be leading armed forces or armed combatant groups that are often the main groups negotiating at the table. So where they may have more influence on the political sphere, if they aren't in military leadership positions in the security sector or in armed combatants, then they may still be seen as honest brokers in those specific conflict contexts. But that said, so first, there are also other ways in which we see women contributing to agreements, to peace negotiations proceeding and agreements being met. So if that piece is that area of influence or channel of influence were removed, there are other channels that we've seen women contribute that would
so I think argue for their support, their participation. So the other thing I wanted to note is that, and this is not directly on your question, but related, is that what we've also heard, another thing that people say is that women aren't actually that peaceful because they aren't strictly peaceful. So we've also seen them in different contexts actually serve in support war or take an active role in conflict, which they would if they were, for example, in military leadership positions. And that's where, you know, one piece of this to highlight is that this is women taking an active, being influential in whatever capacity they serve, whether it is as moderating and peaceful forces in a community or as armed combatants or military leaders. And therefore, we think it critical to involve them in both the prevention and resolution of conflict because they are going to be influential in whatever role they play. So it may take the trust issue away, as you noted, but it instead strengthens the argument of their influence and what they can contribute if provided a leadership role.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Chapman University Fowler School of Law.
Hello, this is Tom Campbell, and thank you, Ms. Biggio, not only for an excellent presentation, but also for your service to our country and our world. I have two questions. One is, the Grameen Bank had quite a success in its micro-lending policies when the recipients were women. I think there's an overwhelming proof that their micro-lending has had more success. And I wonder if, when the recipients have been women, I wonder if the supervision of the financial aspects of peace arrangements being given to women might be a positive and reinforcing step in the reliability of those peace agreements based on the Grameen Bank experience. Second question is just a practical one, and maybe there's other universities on the phone that would have a suggestion. For 5 years, Chapman University, our School of Law, participated in a State Department program for justice reform in Afghanistan, and we brought women to get over to our law school at Chapman to get LLM degrees. So, and several have gone back. They've become professors, and we're very proud of their effect. One of them actually was our valedictorian. But others have stayed. Others have sought political asylum. Others have gone to Canada. And that's kind of the practical question to which you might have some insight. If American universities are going to be engaged in training, what steps can we do to make sure that the recipients of the training go back to the theaters where they are most needed? Thanks again.
Wonderful. Thank you for those questions, and thank you for the great work that your program has done that you've just shared. So on the first part of your question, in terms of what was found on in terms of the Grameen Bank funding, and this has been found in studies of microlending around the world, is that women do have stronger rates of paying back the loans and stronger returns on investment. And taking a step up from microlending, we also see it in terms of small and medium-sized enterprises, that women owned and run small and medium-sized enterprises also contribute significantly to the economic growth of their countries. And actually, research does find similar trends in post-conflict recovery and rebuilding. So women are more likely to direct post-conflict resources to the reconstruction of public institutions and the provision of services that are critical to stability. So again, where resources are directed to women in post-conflict societies, they in turn are more likely to invest it in areas that contribute to the overall stability and recovery of their society. Research also shows that the high levels of women's participation in public sector positions, so as police officers, judges, teachers, medical attendants, that this improves the quality of the service delivery for the entire community. So one study in India actually found that women-led villages women-led villages were more likely than other villages to invest in more in drinking water and infrastructure. They immunized more children, and they had lower gender gaps in school attendance. They also had lower levels of participation as compared to communities led by men. There was another study actually in Kenya that found that women's participation in water and infrastructure committees significantly improved community access to water, and that when women participated in these committees, it resulted in a 44% decrease in the likelihood that access to drinking water would require more than a 60-minute walk. So these are all just examples, like the one that you shared from the Grameen Bank, that in fact, when we help make sure that resources and decision-making opportunities that women are engaged in those in post-conflict societies, that there are stronger returns on investment for the societies at large.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Southern Mississippi.
Hi, this is Todd Berry from USM. I got cut off before. I'm sorry if that caused any problems. But my question, do women's negotiating styles differ from men's, and if so, how? And, for example, would you say that women are more willing to compromise, or would that be just considered a traditional stereotype?
Well, one thing that we have seen in terms of women's negotiating styles in around peace negotiations there are numerous case studies that have documented ways that women have taken a collaborative approach and built coalitions across cultural and sectarian divides. Now, this does require the kind of collaboration that you're noting. And I mean, at the end of the day, it's proved effective for women to get a seat at the table and to advance some of their priorities. So one example of this is in Northern Ireland, where Catholic and Protestant women formed a cross-religious political party. They actually won enough seats through an election that was held before the negotiation started that earned them a formal seat at the negotiating table. And they were then able to jointly negotiate for priorities like education and housing and transitional justice issues that related to some of the specific experiences that both Catholic and Protestant women were experiencing in Northern Ireland. So none of the male parties at the table, for example, had drawn so effectively from both Protestant and Catholic communities and had really as a single party come together with a joint platform to advance some of their shared priorities. And this is something that we've seen across conflict contexts.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Syracuse University.
Thank you. My name is Simone Young, and I'm a Humphrey Fellow here at the Maxwell School. And my question is, do you think that in view of the work of scholars like Valerie Hudson, who study the links between the security of women and the security of states, that there is a need to redefine or expand the way security is viewed? And also, do you think that the greater mainstreaming of gender as a pillar of foreign policy is a mechanism to do this? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. I caught the first part in terms of redefining security. Can you restate the second, please?
The second part is, do you think that the greater mainstreaming of gender as a pillar of foreign policy is a mechanism to do this?
Thank you. Yes, I do. So I think that there is an effort underway in both the U.S. government and across governments and at the international level of bringing more women into the peace and security process. And into our understanding of foreign policy and development more broadly. So there's certainly efforts to invest in and understanding of the importance of investing in gender equality to achieve the sustainable development goals, to better adapt and mitigate climate change, and, you know, in this space specifically, to advance peace and security. And I do think that as we bring more and different perspectives into the conversation about what the risks of to stability are and what potential solutions are to address them, that this will contribute to a shifting and evolving understanding about what security means. And we've seen this happen over the last few decades as there's been growing attention to atrocity prevention and to protecting civilians in conflict as they face greater attacks, and to conflict-related sexual violence as a war crime and a crime against humanity. This is part of, these are examples of our expanding understanding of what national security means, which in turn changes the conversation about how we can best advance security and ensure that our stability efforts are as effective as possible.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Seton Hall University. Okay, our next question comes from Kansas State University.
Hi, I have a question just about how you would suggest giving practical ways to incorporate this just on, like, an ordinary person's level who doesn't maybe have any pull specifically, like, in the government, like they don't have any high roles.
So I think one way is there are efforts in Congress to pass different bills that relate to promoting women's participation in peace and security. So, for example, right now there's a bill that would codify the U.S. National Action Plan on Women, Peace, and Security and help hold U.S. government, U.S. agencies accountable for the commitments that they've made under this policy. Senators Boxer and Shaheen just last week introduced a bill that sets specific targets for the U.S. government to, and specifically the U.S. State Department, to increase the participation of women in security sector training that the U.S. government provides to partner militaries, police, and peacekeeping forces. And so, you know, one step that you and others across our country can do is to help encourage your representatives to support efforts by Congress to pass bills that would take steps like these that encourage the participation of women in security. I think if you look at if you're interested in making individual donations, there are amazing organizations that work closely with local civil society, local women's groups around the world that are involved in peace-building efforts. And so, you know, to the point I highlighted earlier of how little of overall donor aid goes to local groups local women's groups on the ground that are working to advance peace and security. There are a lot of efforts now to try and find ways to make sure that more resources do get to them so that they can do more of the important work that they are already.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Baltimore.
Hi there, this is Assistant Professor Carla Barquero, and I'm here with my wonderful international organization student, so thank you for this great discussion. Our question really comes from the idea of institutional culture. So we were wondering whether or not there are increased efforts to change the institutional cultures around gender inclusion, discrimination, treatment. This comes from some comments we had about the high incident rate of assault within the U.S. military. Upward of 25% of women in the U.S. military are assaulted by officers in the military. And so our concern is, representation and inclusion is one thing, but how do we start changing the institutional culture around women and how they're treated? Thank you.
Thank you for that great question. So I think that's totally right, that as we look to encourage and increase women's participation in peace and security processes, whether it's in the United States or it's in conflict-affected countries, that there are potential risks to women as they come into these roles. And it is important for the institutions, whether it's the Defense Department or its ministries in other countries to put into place policies and support systems that help respond to the risks that women may face, whether it's sexual assault, also looking at where there is needed human resource policies to help increase the recruitment and retention of women and their promotion, and addressing what some of the barriers may be that lead women to leave or not receive promotions at rates comparable to their male counterparts of equal experience. An equal position in some of these contexts. So I think it's a conversation that needs to happen and that is happening, and it's a space where there needs to be more exchange of lessons learned between countries about what it takes to help make sure that once women do come in to these opportunities, that the institutions are addressing the risks that women may face.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the Kyiv Center for Russian and Eastern European and Eurasian Studies.
Oh, hello. My name is Polly, and I have a question about, so when women reach these leadership and social change roles, do you think there's still, like, resistance and doubt from their male counterparts that may cause women to maybe work independently or maybe band with other women? Like, do you think that's still a prevalent issue? And how should we overcome this on both sides of both sexes, from both sexes?
Mm-hmm. I think it really depends on the context. I think that we see in conflict-affected countries around the world and national security sectors around the world that women leaders, once they reach leadership levels, they are still often outnumbered, and to get anything done that they want to accomplish does take strong relationships and coalitions with men across the national security field. So where there may be relationships that are developed where women are trying to work with other women to help ensure that their skills and perspectives are tapped and to hopefully use their leadership roles to encourage the participation of other women in peace and security processes. We also see across contexts that women are really effective in these roles in working with their male counterparts to accomplish the priorities that they're pursuing around peace and security.
Thank you. I think we have time for one last question.
Our last question comes from the University of the South.
My name is Jackson Smith. I'm an undergraduate student at the University of the South. And my question is, do you feel that women negotiators could actually hinder dialogue with many Middle Eastern countries, as women do not traditionally engage in societal functions due to religious-based discrimination?
Right. So this, is one of the arguments that we've heard about how traditional culture is a reason for women not to take stronger leadership roles. I think in these different societies, there are solutions for that that can both still enable women's leadership and their participation while working within the cultural context. And we've seen that both as the U.S. government has sent female leaders, whether foreign policy or national security or specifically military leaders, to countries all around the world that have different cultural practices and norms around gender roles. And solutions are found that still help get business done. And this, was certainly the experience of the female secretaries of state that we've had in the last decade or so, as well as senior U.S. Military leaders that are working in and have traveled to societies, more conservative societies. The other piece is that in these societies, there are also female leaders that are looking to contribute to the peace and security process. And there are creative ways that they can advise and their male counterparts can advise that can help make sure that women are engaging and have an opportunity to contribute. I think that it's important not to take the norm of exclusion and extend it in our own support and assume that women's participation that and not look for opportunities to encourage women's participation. The other piece that I just note with that is it's also important for us to do that because we've seen that in post-conflict societies that women's participation in the peace or transition process can actually present an opportunity to lay the groundwork for a more equitable and prosperous future for the conflict-affected country, given the evidence that when women participate in economic, political, and social lives, that this is correlated with prosperity and growth. So in fact, we're finding opportunities to encourage women's participation and their contribution. This will help the society in the long run if they're able to more effectively engage women across their economic and political and social spaces, and they'll see more prosperity and growth from that.
Well, Jamila Biggio, thank you very much for today's call, for your insights, sharing your insights with us, and for everybody's terrific questions. We really appreciate it. Follow on our website our Women in Foreign Policy blog, to which Jamila contributes. If you go to the front of our homepage, CFR.org, you will find it there. And do you also tweet, Jamila?
I do, yes.
What is your handle?
My handle is Astramila Biggio, so my first and last name.
Wonderful. So you should follow her there as well. So thank you again. Our next call will be on Wednesday, October 12th at noon Eastern Time with James Lindsay, our Senior Vice President, Director of Studies here at CFR, and he will talk about the role of foreign policy in this presidential campaign. So I hope that you will join us for that. You can follow us on our handle on Twitter at @CFR_academic for information on new CFR resources and upcoming events. So thank you all again.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.